Paul Singer is the founder and co-CEO of Elliott Management Corporation. It is the ninth largest hedge fund, and as of July 1st, 2018, Elliott Management oversees approximately $35 billion in assets. Mr. Singer is a billionaire, and some would also say he is a bully. What he is for sure is an activist investor. And while that sounds like a good thing, it's up for debate. Though Singer has had a very good track record of uncovering corporate waste and corruption and increasing company growth and revenue, his tactics are also seen as predatory, unscrupulous, and morally reprehensible. One CEO calls Singer's maneuvers, quote, psychoterror. Reporter Sheila Kohatker takes an in-depth look at Paul Singer and his methodologies in her article for The New Yorker, The Doomsday Investor. Sheila, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
So, okay, talk to me about this. Paul Singer is known as the world's most feared investor. So who fears him and why do they fear him so?
He's developed a reputation as an adversarial activist investor. And I should point out that Singer and his employees like to say that many of their investments proceed without a lot of conflict. However, a remarkable number of them end up, sort of mired in a lot of drama. And just to give you one example, the company that I profiled in The New Yorker, Athena Health, Elliott Management, Singer's hedge fund, took a 9% shareholder stake in the company. They started pushing and pressuring and encouraging the company management to make changes that they thought would be good for the company and they thought would drive the stock price up. And the company resisted, and ultimately, after a flurry of very negative and embarrassing news articles, the CEO resigned, and now the company is up for sale. And this pattern has repeated itself many, many times.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems like in certain cases that you referenced, he sort of takes a hammer to some of these companies. Now, I'm going to jump around a little bit, because you mentioned that he had a 9% stake in Athena Health. And the first thing I thought is, how can someone that's only got 9% of the company pull all these strings and put so much pressure on them to do anything?
Well, the dynamic is really interesting, and I know that in the case of Athena, there were other shareholders who held larger percentages of stock who kind of privately would say, well, why does Elliott get to decide what
exactly
happens with this company? Yeah, you know, it's a very good question, and that's why I thought it was worth examining in this way, because I don't think people quite realize what goes on. Part of the power that Mr. Singer and his fund have is that people are scared of them. And again, they like to point out that they are simply identifying companies with problems. And it's true that they are very good at finding companies where there are conflicts of interest among the board, or, you know, they're very eccentric managers at the company who they feel are not doing a good enough job. They sometimes find companies where there's, you know, fraud taking place. So they like to argue that they're simply identifying these problems that exist already, and then that by putting this pressure on the company, it forces all of this to come out. It forces the management to change. And of course, in the process, Elliott makes usually a lot of money, because the stock will shoot up. Simply news that Elliott has purchased a stake in a particular company will cause the stock price to go up. It's remarkable because they have this reputation, this fearsome reputation, and it really just sort of feeds into itself. People are scared of them and want to avoid getting on their bad side.
Is a lot of what drives profits and things like that in this whole world of finance emotion, like the fact that he is known as this feared investor, and when he's involved in something and is interested, that makes the price go up. If he does this, that makes the price go down. I mean, it's a lot of that, rumor, innuendo and emotion.
The emotion is always a huge factor when it comes to investing and the stock market.
Yeah.
I mean, it's remarkable. A number of people I spoke with while I was reporting this piece said, well, often when dealing with managers at Elliott who own shares in their companies, you know, the analysts at Elliott would have compiled sort of a folder of information. They do a very in-depth financial analysis of the company, but often there's sort of a more personal component about the CEO and the other top executives at the company, and those people are very embarrassed and terrified of this information being publicized.
There you go.
And it's happened enough times that
mm-hmm.
they fear that it really might happen, and they don't want to get onto Elliott's bad side.
Wow.
Yep.
Can you describe for us what an activist investor is? Because when I saw that phrase, I thought, oh, these are investors who invest in kind of the kinds of things that I'm interested in, you know, oh, sharing of wealth, oh, helping end hunger, poverty, activist things. But that's not an activist investor, is it?
It means activist in the sense of not being passive, the opposite of a passive investor. And it's true that a lot of big holders of shares in public companies are large mutual funds like Fidelity and Vanguard. They tend to be more passive. They're not in there inside the company boardroom telling the board of directors and the CEO and the CFO what to do and what they think they should be doing. An activist investor is very different. Their intention is to heavily research the company, take this stake in the company. Often they reveal it through surprise, so the company only really figures out that Elliot owns these shares sort of after it's already happened.
Oh, man.
And then they use that, their role as like a major shareholder, to get in the face of the company managers and, you know, theoretically argue and push and encourage changes that are going to cause the stock price to go up. And of course, there's a lot of debate about some of the changes that they tend to ask for and who they really benefit.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the press, Singer and these other activist investors, they're referred to by all these kind of animalistic terms, vultures, wolves, hyenas, because I guess it's that same predatory nature of how they work, which what you just described, correct?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the amount of sort of drama and hysteria that has accompanied some of their higher profile investments has really contributed to this reputation. And, you know, very famously, they took a position in Argentine sovereign debt. And this was sort of the investment that they were most famous for. Ultimately, you know, Elliot bought up a bunch of defaulted sovereign bonds of Argentina, an independent country, refused to exchange their bonds for, you know, a sort of a lower price when Argentina entered a huge financial crisis, and were in a way responsible for pushing the country to default on its debt, which is a remarkable thing. So people in Argentina frequently, you know, referred to Mr. Singer as a vulture and a vulture investor, and that term is meant to evoke this idea of someone who makes money from the misery and suffering of someone else.
I mean, really, not only other companies but countries. How much did Argentina end up ultimately paying out to Singer?
Several billion dollars. Singer ended up through patience and relentless willingness to spend money over a period of years and years litigating the case. He ultimately made an enormous return on his investment. And again, every time that happens, people read about it in the newspaper. CEOs of American companies read about that. So then when suddenly Elliot pops up in their own company, they're quite terrified.
I would think.
Yeah. And it was quite interesting to me because there's a huge industry now in the U.S. of advisors and lawyers and accounting experts and public relations professionals who exist solely to advise company CEOs about what to do when an activist investor comes into their company.
I mean, God,
how to fend them off, how to defend.
He's like, literally created a cottage industry.
He has. It's remarkable.
I'm speaking with a New Yorker staff writer, Sheila Kolhatkar, about her latest article, The Doomsday Investor. So, all right, so this dude, Elliot Singer, he has not only gone into vulnerable companies, but he's going into vulnerable countries, developing nations. What gave him the idea to make that leap? And it wasn't just Argentina. It was Peru. It was countries in Africa, the Republic of Congo. How did he get that crazy idea?
Well, during the 80s and 90s, I mean, this is an ongoing story. Of course, in the 80s and 90s, there was a high number of financial crises in developing countries, countries with fragile economies. And there was a bond trader named Jay Newman, who was working at another firm, actually, not working for Mr. Singer, but he had figured out that there was a way to make money from these financial crises. You could buy up these kind of crashing bonds for very little money. And then typically what would happen is when a country has a big financial crisis, it defaults on its debt, the IMF would come in and try and help them renegotiate the debt, repair their economy, impose austerity measures. But if you buy those defaulted bonds and you refuse to participate in the debt renegotiation, you can just sue the country until they pay you back in full, even though most of the other bondholders took a big price reduction.
But in that pressure to and the lawsuit, I mean, that helped make those countries get into very serious financial trouble.
Well, a lot of people argue that. Now, again, the so-called vulture investors would argue that they would never, they always said, we would never sue a country that can't afford to pay us. Now, of course, there are a lot of people don't agree with them, but that is what they would say. They said they would only pick people who can afford to pay, and we are teaching these countries to honor their contracts,
oh,
and that's
boy.
Really important.
Oh, are you
for
kidding me?
So that's their argument.
I can see but I mean, he picked developing nations. I mean, he picked nations that were really in trouble, so that doesn't seem to, that doesn't jibe with that.
Well, one of the things I found interesting about Mr. Singer and the people who work for him is that they do not mind venturing into investment areas that others might find to be distasteful. So a lot of people who just would simply not do that kind of investing, and he is not put off by that.
Wow.
He will forge ahead where others feel too embarrassed or possibly ashamed to venture.
This is another way of framing boldly going where no man has ever gone before, to take from Star Trek. I'm just curious, what political causes and what players has Paul Singer supported? I said Elliot Singer before, I meant Paul Singer. Where does he lie in the political spectrum?
Well, Mr. Singer is one of the largest and most influential Republican donors, donors to Republican political candidates and Republican causes. He's right up there with the Kochs, with the Mercers, with Sheldon Adelson, all those like big money donors you hear about.
Right.
Mr. Singer is right up there. So,
but he didn't start as necessarily a Trump supporter, which I would think all of those did. He didn't begin that way, did he?
No, he was favoring much more traditional, small government, low tax Republican candidates. And in fact, in the last presidential election, he, you know, after much suspense, he announced that he was supporting Marco Rubio. And he poured tremendous resources into Senator Rubio's campaign. And of course, that didn't work out. I mean, Trump ended up shocking the Republican establishment and not only becoming the nominee, but then winning the general election, shocking still. But the fact is that Mr. Singer is enormously influential. He has a major role in choosing the Republican Party's candidate for president, and also on the congressional level, he's also very involved. So that's why I think just the fact of how he makes his money and what he does with it is of relevance to everyone.
Sheila, would you call him a megalomaniac?
That's a term I hear used a lot to describe people of his standing. However, I wouldn't describe Mr. Singer that way, because he's actually personally quite retiring. He's almost like, the way he speaks, he's almost like a nerdy professor, and he's quite, he has a soft voice. He is not as flashy with his wealth as some other hedge fund billionaires you might have heard of. You don't read about his enormous $100 million art world purchases in the newspaper,
okay,
whereas many of his contemporaries are out doing those things. He is of course enormously wealthy, but he's quieter about it.
Okay, so he's maybe a hidden megalomaniac, minomaniac.
Yeah, I think he wants to funnel his riches into political influence and ideas he cares about, and that is how he, you know, he feels that he should be deploying his resources.
I have to read that what he said he wanted the headline of his life to be. He said he tried to make a difference. He protected a lot of people's capital over a long period of time. He was steady, reliable. Oh, I hear the music in my ear, which means I think I have to sign off. Such a delight talking with you, Sheila. I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer Sheila Kohlhatker about her latest article, The Doomsday Investor.